This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on October 27, 2000. Our speaker is Gary T. of San Jose, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Okay, we're now on the seventh edition. We have no dues or fees in AA, but do pay our own way.
Well, how are you guys doing tonight? All right, we got any drunks in the room? Yeah? Well, if you're not a drunk, I don't know what the hell you're doing here. There's other things you could be doing on a Friday night. I'm Gary T., and my sobriety birthday is May 28th, 1989. And Saturday Night Live is where I got sober, so this place is very, very special to me. I understand it's a Halloween dance tonight, and somebody asked me if I were going to be wearing a costume, and I said, yeah, I'm going to wear a coat and tie and impersonate a presidential candidate. I promise if I'm elected, I'll put Alcoholics Anonymous in a lockbox. No. One of the things I do with my life now that's part of the changes that have come about since I came into this program is I work in the helping professions, and I work with people with disabilities and help them to find jobs. And one of the questions that I ask when somebody comes in to talk to me about what they'd like to do with their lives, and I'll tell them, let's think up a scenario. Let's say you fall asleep tonight. And during the night, a miracle happens. And everything that's plagued you in your life is gone. If you're an alcoholic, your alcoholism's done. All the pain of the past is gone. If you're physically disabled, that's taken care of. Everything is gone. A miracle has happened. You wake up the next morning, and you're free. And the question I ask is, what would you do with your life? And usually what people tell me are their dreams and their aspirations and their deepest hopes. Those things that we keep locked tight in our hearts that we'd like to do. Well, we alcoholics, if you're anything like me, and I'm sure you are, we're great dreamers. And we have a lot of aspirations. But as we're walking down the path of our life and we're reaching out for those dreams, somehow it always seems that it's just a little bit too far away. We just can't seem to grasp it. And we don't know why. And a lot of us stay locked up within ourselves wondering, what the hell's going on? And why is it that I can't seem to do relationships? Or I can't seem to achieve what success I'm looking for. And why is my life such a mess? And a lot of us don't know. Because deep inside and up here, we're very intelligent. We're very bright people. And yet we happen to live our lives not knowing quite how to live life. And that's the way that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1989. No matter how successful you are, and in terms of employment, I was successful. No matter how successful you ever are, if you're somebody like me and you're practicing alcoholism and drinking, there's always that emptiness inside, that lonely place that exists in there, that you're not quite sure how to fill it. And if you're anything like me, you spend most of your life trying to figure out how to take that emptiness and put something in there to replace it. Because certainly money won't do it. Materialistic things won't do it. Having all the relationships in the world won't do it if something's not quite in here. And as I'm wont to do in thinking about my life from the minute I walked in these rooms to today, I thought about the blessings that you people have brought me here since I've been in these rooms. I thought about the fact that when I came in here, I was a mess. And I look at myself 11 and a half years later, thanks to your love and the discipline you gave me, that I have finally fulfilled a lot of the dreams of my life, with more to come. Now, I know there's some people in the room that have heard my story before, but a couple of days ago, I was in here in a meeting, and a couple of meetings over the past week, and some people that really, really meant something to me when I was a newcomer in the room quoted some things from the book and kind of weaved their story into it. And I said, gosh, well, you know, when I was a newcomer, I needed to hear some of that stuff. I needed to hear some of these gems that exist in this precious book, because it helped me to understand why I was an alcoholic and why I did some of the things that I did. If you look at our book, it opens up, and it's got a really profound statement in there. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And when I looked at that the first time I ever read it, it says, not in recovery, but who have recovered. And it says, precisely how we have recovered. If you go to the back of the book, right there near the end, it says, most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he doesn't close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. And that word means can't be neglected. And down at the bottom of that, there's this precious little quote that says, there's a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. And that principle is contempt prior to investigation. And the word contempt means actions of a mental state of one who feels it's beneath him. Well, if you think about it, we alcoholics, of which I'm one, we got into a place, if you're anything like me, when I walked into this room, where you're pretty skeptical. We're the sorts of people, as John Kenneth Galbraith once said, faced with the choice between changing one's mind and proving that there's no need to do so, we get hung up on the proof. When I walked into this room, my life was in a shambles. I had a divorce or a marriage that was falling apart. I had a career going, but I didn't know how to deal with the stress of that career. And the way my life started was a little bit unusual for a lot of people. I was born 2 months and 2 weeks premature. Within 3 weeks, I had a surgery on the left side of my face and on my ear. I had another one at 6 months. At 5 years old, I had yet another one, where they had to restructure my ear and remove part of the brain, which a lot of people claim is why I'm so nuts now. But as a child growing up with disabilities, who had a rather funny-looking face for a long time, I never felt a part of. But there was one thing that kind of kept me linked and kept me going, and that was music. Now, I don't know why this is. I had grandparents that were beautiful singers. Melodic voices, just incredible opera singers, and I spent my childhood listening to them sing opera and Italian folk songs. And out of all my relatives, my brothers, my cousins, my nieces and nephews, the guy that wound up with the music genes was the hearing impaired kid. And I thought to myself, you know, as I think about it now, God must have had something to show me through all of that. When I was growing up in high school, I was the guy that was always picked on. I was the shortest guy in the class, and I remember one instance. I'm in high school, and these bunch of guys surrounded me. I went to a Catholic high school, and it was one of those high schools back in those days where the guys were on one side, the gals were on the other side, and you know, you never crossed that lace curtain in the middle, as they used to call it. But anyway, a couple of guys, a group of about 10 guys are surrounding me, and they're trying to get me to fight them, and I'm the littlest guy there. And I remember saying in the back of my mind at that moment, I want to do something that you guys would like to do that will get me a lot of power and prestige, and that's my way of getting back at you. And from that moment on, I decided to have a successful career in music no matter what, and that's what my life was directed toward. My heroes during that time were Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, because he was also hearing impaired, and Beethoven, and any black singer who ever sang R&B and blues, because I could relate to their pain. And I would hide, just like Brian Wilson, I would hide in my room, where it's a place that I could go and tell my troubles to. I had a dad that was a rageaholic, a mom who was the adult child of an alcoholic, who was a very violent alcoholic, but that guy I never knew, because my grandfather got sober at 94 and stayed sober until his death at 94. Sober at 44, dead at 94. And there's a little bit of my story I'll tell you about there. So anyway, I went through all through high school. I took my first drink when I was 15 years old. I remember walking or riding down the streets of Broad Street in Philadelphia, which is like the main drag, and there was this beautiful neon sign when I was a kid. Used to see it every time we went down there for Rolling Rock Premium Beer. And I swore that when I could drink, I was going to drink Rolling Rock Premium Beer. Well, here you got this kid that's very insecure, very, very uptight, very withdrawn, scared that every time he went out of the house, somebody was going to make some comment about him. And lo and behold, a couple of my friends took me out and gave me my first drink of Rolling Rock Premium Beer. And it was like love at first sight, or first drink. And from that time on, I became a weekend warrior. I was one of those people where my dad had this liquor cabinet that he used to keep locked up. And I was the person that found a way to get the lock by taking a fork and putting it in the lock in such a way that I could open it. Well, I take a little bit of this, and a little bit of that, and a little bit of this, and a little bit of that, and I make a cocktail. My dad asked me one time, are you getting in here and drinking any of this stuff? I said, nope, absolutely not. He changed the lock. I found a way to pick that one. And eventually he got rid of all the booze. But the thing that alcohol did for me was it allowed me to be the person that I thought I wanted to be. All that uptightness, the insecurities came off of me. And I could finally be funny, likable. And then, from that point on, my alcoholism started taking off. I got into college. My first year in college, I went to Bloomsburg State in upstate Pennsylvania. You probably have never heard of the town. The only reason why Bloomsburg has any notoriety at all is because a country singer named Lacey J. Dalton grew up there. So if there's any country fans, maybe you remember her. And she was one of the people that I hung out with when I was at Bloomsburg State. And of course, I partied hardy. I was partying all the time. Forgot about my schoolwork. I was finally on my own. I'm free. And I spent every weekend doing what we do and during the week. Well, I wound up flunking out of school. So much for that. My dad wasn't too happy about that. Neither was my mom. I didn't care. Wound up working for a while at Foco Ford and then went to night school. And finally decided, because I originally decided that I was going to be a social studies history teacher, that I was fooling myself. That was something I wanted to do to please my parents. So I got the radio and music bug and switched majors, went to Temple University, and became a broadcast major. Well, lo and behold, it was the hippie years. And Hippie Hay was there, and so was I. And we used to go up. I lived in a mixed neighborhood called Germantown, and Germantown was really great because you'd hear all the most incredible jazz you'd ever want to hear about three blocks away from where I lived in the clubs that went down Germantown Avenue. There was a Baptist church down on the corner that really got up and got into it. And since it was a mixed neighborhood, everybody seemed to get along with everyone else. And I got to hang around with these musicians, and they taught me a lot. It was really my African-American friends who taught me how to sing. It was them who told me how I could come in from the depths of my heart and let the pain out and get released through that. So I hit into music again. Got through college. I don't know how, because I was doing acid a couple of times a week. We used to go up on the top of my building, and there were radio towers over there. And I mean this. We used to sit there and watch the lights on the tower blink on and off. Oh, well. Well, I did manage to make it through Temple University. At the same time, I was dancing at Record Hops for a couple of notable Philadelphia disc jockeys, and one of them happened to be a guy who came out here in 1971 and put a legendary station called KOME on the air. And he brought about four of us out here from Philadelphia, and I was one of those people. And I thought to myself, my God, I mean, I'm going to be in the Bay Area. I'm near San Francisco. Haight-Ashbury, hippies, the whole thing. And I thought, this is nirvana. And it was, because from the time I got here and the time I started working at that station, drugs were available. I never had to pay for it. Booze was available. Never had to pay for it. I remember the first time in my life I ever did cocaine, I was doing a night shift, and somebody brought by The horn section from Tower of Power. So anyway, I'm sitting there and I'm doing an interview with them, and all of a sudden, the road manager pulls out this block of white stuff, and he gets a chunk off of it, and then he rips out 100 and starts passing it around. I don't know what the hell it is. Honestly, I didn't know what it was. And it finally comes over to me, and I off mic, I said, what do I do with this? He said, well, just take a couple of lines and use the dollar bill, $100 bill, and snort it up your nose, which I immediately did, and went about to ask a question and stopped dead in the middle of the question while the entire horn section is laughing. Well, anyway, I mentioned drugs in here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to confine a lot of my remarks to dealing with alcohol, but like a lot of us in this room, and particularly baby boomers and those who have come later, I was dually and triply addicted to other stuff, and that's part of my story. So I hope I don't offend anybody here through talking about it, because it's my reality and it's the reality of a lot of us. Well, anyway, living the rock and roll lifestyle, as I mentioned, was like a dream came true. And if any of you were around here 20 years ago, that station was just one of the most over-the-top stations in the country. And we lived hard and we lived fast. Now, oddly enough, I was the guy that when I would be sitting around with a bunch of rockers at a table drinking, I was the guy they would ask to stop. Because while these guys who are not necessarily, you know, soft drinkers themselves would be going through what they're going through, I would probably do a pitcher and the time would take them to do two or three. And I would become a mess. I would get just really bent out of shape. I remember the night that John Lennon died, I was at some sort of thing up in San Francisco. I don't remember. I was in a blackout. The only thing I remember that night was walking out and looking at the television and seeing a little note flash across the screen that said John Lennon had died. And that's the only reason why that night remains in my mind at all. It took a friend of mine about 5 years ago to tell me what had happened that night, that I had gotten pulled over, that my wife at that time was asked to drive because I was a mess, and fortunately, by the grace of God, I didn't get picked up on a DUI. A lot of us managed to do that. I never had that happen to me. As I went through this rock and roll lifestyle, living and partying, I developed an image. And it was the image that you wanted to hear when I was on the radio. Whenever you had met me, that's who I was. And I wouldn't shake from that. You know why? Because down deep inside, there was this really terrified little boy who didn't want you to know who I really was. So it's safe and convenient for me to hide behind that image I concocted back then. Well, then, somewhere along the way, about 1980 or so, I was at a concert, and it was a Boston concert, and I had earplugs in my ear, which we all did because the noise was very loud, and I pulled an earplug out of my ear to talk to a guy that was sitting in about the third row, and Tom Scholz, the lead guitarist, hit a note, and my hearing in my right ear dropped about 45 dB in a millisecond and never came back. And what happened to me was my first bottom, first of many. All of a sudden when I realized that I had lost my hearing, I've already been deaf in my left ear, was, oh my God, I've been in the music business since I was 16 years old. What the hell am I going to do now? My wife at that time and I weren't getting along. She left me. I was very alone, scattered out. The station was going through some trauma and our ratings were going down. And I did what every alcoholic in his right mind does. I did a geographic to Eugene, Oregon, figuring if I just move, everything will be better. And I started working at a radio station there, and I had a group of friends in Eugene because I worked there during the 70s. And I was just gone into the disease. I was drinking when I was on the air, which was something I never did before then, except once in a while. More than once in a while. Oh, God. But because my wife had left me and because my hearing had dropped and I didn't know what to do about it, I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I spun out more and more and got deeper and deeper in alcohol. And then finally one night, notice when we alcoholics blow it, we just don't blow it in a tiny way. We like to blow it in big ways. So it happened to be a Saturday night. I'm working at this station in Eugene, Oregon. The next day is what they call Oregon Jam, which was like day on the green. It's Saturday night. I've got the night shift. there are people all the way up and down the West Coast that are there for the concert, a lot of whom I knew. And my wife and I at that time had had a battle over some things connected with our divorce, and I got whom I knew. And my wife and I at that time had had a battle over some things connected with our divorce, and I got pissed off, and I started drinking before I got on the air. And I kept on drinking malt liquor while I was on the air. Finally, some guy called up and requested a Starship song. And I said, "The Starship? I can't stand the fucking Starship. I hate the fucking Starship. I can't." What I didn't know is that I had flicked a switch and the entire city of Eugene heard this that comment. And the next thing that I knew, some guy's coming in and sitting down and saying, "Guess what you did?" And I went, "I have no idea." And he told me, he said, "You're done." And that was it. And the reason why that all happened, I realize now, is the course of doing the steps, is that it was so painful for me to leave that business that I self-destructed myself out of it. Now, fortunately, God in His mercy and His grace brought me back down to San Jose. For what reason, I have no idea. But after one of many bottoms, I went through a spiritual experience and felt a closeness to God and started going to church. And for a while, that really helped me out quite a bit. I landed a new career after retraining as a technical writer. It was very successful. I was a supervisor in a high-tech firm. Everything's going well. And then I met her. And we got involved. And then I married her. And then the night that we got married, as I'm looking at her, I went, "Oh, my God, what have I done?" Because it dawned on both of us that there was no way in hell that either one of us should have been married to each other. Anybody gone through that? It's got to be one of the most frightening experiences you've ever had in your life. And I started drinking. And she started drinking. And the drinking got worse. Well, fortunately, there was a woman who was a bridesmaid in our wedding party named Linda Schultz, who was a member of this program. And I'd known Linda for years. And she knew what was happening to me and took me to my very first meeting. It was at an Oakland convention. And there was a guy who was a speaker there who told my story. And I was just simply amazed. I said, "How could anybody know me that well?" And I had no idea that Alcoholics Anonymous was a place where people talked about God. Now, I know there's quite a few people who get all hung up about God, but this is a spiritual program. And God is a real important thing of it. The difference is we don't tell you what kind of God to have. You can have any God that you choose. Now, if you choose a doorknob as God, please use the doorknob to open the door and see what happens. But anyway, Linda took me to meetings in Saturday Night Live, and I'll never forget, about my third meeting at Saturday Night Live, John Carney was here, as he usually is, and Peggy, who has since gone on. And John stood up and talked about how he was an alcoholic who had his life and his marriage in a mess, how his first wife had offed herself, and how he met this wonderful lady, got sober, and he called her his pretty little Al-Anon lady. And he got up and talked, and then Peggy got up and talked. And I grabbed onto that because it gave me hope, and I said, maybe if I hang around here, I can get my marriage back together, or whatever. Maybe something that can happen to me that can change my life. So I hung on to that. Now, the marriage didn't come back together. As a matter of fact, we got pretty insane. And Bob Manick at that time was my sponsor. And he'd look at me and he'd say, "Gary, what's going on?" I say, "Oh, Cindy's just absolutely nuts. I'm trying to stay sober. She's drinking every night. I don't know what to do." And I said, "Maybe I should stay with her." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Gary, no. What do you want to do?" I said, "Bob, I have no idea. I don't know what I want." And he calmly looked at the steps and went, "There you go." Now, what are these steps all about? This is nothing more than a structure which allows us to take the bits and pieces of our life that have been really clobbering us and come to terms with it. A lot of us are in denial. That's why the first step is the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Who the hell wants to ever admit you're powerless over alcohol? Who wants to admit you're an alcoholic? There's a lot of people working in recovery circles right now that say, well, saying you're an alcoholic stigmatizes you. Well, back in the days when this program got started, in the 30s, being an alcoholic was akin to being someone with AIDS right now. You were shunned by everybody. Nobody wanted anything to do with you. They basically just put us off in a corner somewhere, put us in the hospitals. We either died or something happened and maybe we got sober. The idea behind saying we're alcoholics in this meeting is because the denial is so thick. I heard a definition of denial yesterday I really liked. Denial is a first-class excuse for incompetence. Whoa, that's tough. That's hard. What does it mean? If I admit I'm an alcoholic, that means I admit that I can't control my drinking. And then along with that I can't control my life. Along with that I can't control my relationships. Along with that I can't control just about everything that's going on with me. Who the hell wants to admit that? Who wants to admit that down deep, in a moment of clarity and honesty, that you have to admit before yourself that your life's not working for you? That's what the first step is about. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable as a result. Now, one of the things that gets mentioned in the book that I really like is one of the most beautiful descriptions of addiction I've ever heard. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Just put in whatever else is going on in there. You know, drugs, stay on the internet for 12 hours, whatever's going on. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They're restless, irritable, discontent, unless they can gain, once again, experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with immunity. After they succumb to desire again, as many do, the phenomenon of craving develops again. And they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, immersing remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. And this is repeated over and over again unless this person, me, you, whomever, can experience an entire psychic change. There's very little hope of recovery. That psychic change is what we term a spiritual awakening, however that may happen with you. Once that change has occurred, this very same person who seemed doomed, but had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control its desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Ooh, rules, you mean I have to do something? Ooh, well, we're rebellious by nature. Don't tell me what to do. You ain't going to tell me what to do. I can honestly say that that kind of attitude in my life kept me very miserable for a very long time. There's another part in the book that talks about, see if I can find it here. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, although it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months the goose held high. That means he got drunk a lot. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. Well, you know, if self-knowledge and having a lot of knowledge worked, is there anybody in the room that doesn't know the consequences of smoking tobacco? Yeah, we all smoke. Not all of us, but some of us smoke. So self-knowledge doesn't help. You could have all the knowledge about alcohol. You can know the chemistry behind alcohol. You could understand that maybe if I just get my thinking together, I'll be able to stay sober. Recently, there was a whole thing about a movement called moderation drinking. Now, there are some people out there that can learn to moderate their drinking. Social drinkers do not have to moderate their drinking. They just don't drink very much. That's the bottom line. Moderation drinking, if you're thinking about that, and you're an alcoholic like I am, then you're still obsessed about drinking, and you're still obsessed about alcohol. Normal people do not go to a bar or to a dinner thinking about, oh my God, if I have four drinks tonight, I can save them up and then I can have 10 drinks on Friday night. They don't do that. Okay. But there are people out there who do not have our disease, you know, college students in their party phase, things like that. They're not real alcoholics, and there's no need for them to possibly be in this program because, you know, they can learn how to moderate their drinking, and the book talks about that. But if you're an alcoholic like I am, there ain't no such thing as moderation. I mean, I tried that before I got into this program. I tried to moderate my drinking. There were times when I didn't drink at all. You wouldn't have wanted to be in this body during that time when I wasn't drinking, because my head was still playing games with me. Here's another part of the book. You let somebody drink for a day, and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision is made or engagement kept. A little earlier it says, he's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He's seldom mildly intoxicated, and more or less is always insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little, and he may be one of the finest fellows in the world. But when it comes to alcohol, in that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish. Does it sound like anybody around here that's in the room? Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the whole cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. Oh, wow. My stinking thinking. What we also talk about in this room is a spiritual solution, because this is a spiritual program, and the spiritual solution is a necessary part of it. Now, when I came in here, like a lot of people, I had a lot of spiritual information. I had grown up in a Catholic church. I had been going to a Christian church. And, you know, for a lot of us that grow up in churches, our idea of God is sort of like Zeus in the mountains with lightning bolts, ready to come down and get you at any moment. All you have to do is the wrong thing. And I remember in my life as a little kid, right before I went to confession, my stomach would get all knotted up because I was convinced that if I didn't say the right sins to Father so-and-so, that God was going to strike me dead on the spot. That's the kind of God I grew up with. If you're a woman, it's even harder maybe to reconcile what God is, because you have this angry Zeus-type male figure with lightning bolts. Okay? So we come in here with a lot of baggage about who God is, and a lot of baggage that sometimes keeps us from dealing with the concept. I like what Dr. Neal once said at one point. God is indefinable. And what we do is we spend our lives trying to define Him in a way that we can understand Him. So God, as you understand Him, initially may be something very, very small to you. That's what it was to me. And then that understanding grows and grows and grows and grows and grows as you grow. In the course of doing my second run through the steps, my second year in sobriety, and I did the steps at that point according to the book, everything, all the writing the book and the 12x12 suggests, I got in touch with some pretty heavy sexual abuse issues that I had kept down there. Never came into my mind, never thought about it. In the course of going through the steps, God at about 2 o'clock in the morning revealed all this crap to me. And I immediately got up and wrote stuff. Then the next morning I said, well, my sponsor's not around. Who am I going to share this with? And God told me, well, why don't you call your friend Linda, who 12-stepped you? And I grabbed her after a meeting and sat her, and we sat down, and I shared all this stuff with her. I mean, some really gross stuff that happened. And boy, it was totally freeing. In that instant, I understood why I treated women the way I treated them. I understood why all of my relationships had gone south. And in the meantime, I'm sharing this with a woman. I mean, this is the kind of stuff I'd have a hard time sharing with a guy. And when it was done, I was meditating, because one thing I did put into practice was the 10th step. I meditate in the morning. I meditate at night before I go to sleep. That's what helped keep me sane. I pray the step prayer. There's reasons why they ask us to do this stuff, is so we can maintain a level of tranquility and peace. And I said, you know, of all things, why did I share this with a woman? And I heard this voice inside me say, well, you always did want to share your deep, darkest secrets with a woman. Guess what? You just did. And the freedom that I got from that was beyond anything I can tell you. My relationships with everybody began getting better. Everybody. Well, along the way, 1994, I'm going along in my tech career, and I suffered from some physical stuff, basically connected with carpal tunnel, that capsized that career. And I'm sitting there. I've gone through about 4 surgeries in 4 years' time, wondering what I'm going to do with my life. And one of the surgeries I'd gone through was a major reconstruction on my face. And this was, I was at that point going to graduate school. I made a decision eventually on what I wanted to do. And I came out of the facial surgery and I was all freaked out, because my face, as it would be after facial surgery, was all bloated and, you know, all that. And I looked in the mirror and went, oh my God, I could be at the Halloween dance tonight and not change a thing. But anyway, I was freaked. I called one person in this program, and I'm in the hospital at Stanford University. By 2 hours later, 3 hours later, I had about 15 people from this program in my room. But what really makes this kind of interesting is that I'm lying in the bed at Stanford, and I wake up, and there on the TV is one of the members of this program, a guy named Billy D, who says commercials. And Billy D's talking to some woman about bread. And I fell back asleep. Woke up about 20 minutes later, and there's Billy D talking to some woman about cheese. And I said, well, this must be Billy D's hot tips on picking up women in a supermarket. What did I know? I thought nothing of it. A group of people in the program took me up to Martinez and took care of me for 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, I'm still on some drugs because of the pain, and I'm kind of trying to get off them. And I'm in my apartment by myself, and I've got a bottle of Vicodin about that far away. And I wanted to take it. Guess what happens? I'm watching Babylon 5, and there on my picture tube is Billy D doing a commercial for some defunct internet company. And I said, maybe I ought to call somebody in the program. So I called this friend of mine who was over at my house in 10 minutes, and I couldn't wear my glasses or anything like that because my face was so swollen. And she took me through the whole process of why I was so scared and bent out of shape. And it turned out that I had graduate school starting in 2 weeks, and when I was 5 years old, when I went to kindergarten, I was terrified. And all the kids made fun of me because of the way I looked. And I was obsessed on the fact that having just had the surgery, I was going to go back to school and everybody was going to make fun of me. The reason why I mention that is that's what I've learned in this program to do when I get into trouble, is call somebody on the phone. When I feel that moment where I want to pick something up and do something with it, I don't waste any time. I went through a situation a couple of weeks back where I was having some problems dealing with some issues connected with my first wife. I'm running up St. Joseph's Hill. I'm running back down St. Joseph's Hill in Los Gatos. I said, gosh, you know, maybe I ought to call my sponsor and deal with this. Next thing I know, I feel a tap on my shoulder. I look around, it's my sponsor. Well, that's instant prayer. And my sponsor told me what to do and what to write. He gave me some suggestions, and I wrote it. And that part of my life was cleaned up. When I was in graduate school, I'm having these problems financially, like a lot of graduate students do. And Pam and I, my wife, who was my girlfriend at that time, we sat in our room and we prayed. We said, God, you know, Gary wants to get through the next semester. He needs some money to do it. Will you help him? And that's all we said. I went down to my mailbox, opened up the mailbox. There was a check for $10,000 sitting there. It turned out I had been in a graduate program that had a stipend connected to it a year before and completely forgot about it. And that check was mailed to me. Now, what makes the whole thing interesting is that when we prayed the prayer, God already had answered it because the check was sitting in the mailbox. Now, some people, skeptics among us, might say, well, that's ridiculous, Gary. That kind of thing doesn't happen. My experience is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it surely does. When I become willing to turn my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. After going through that second inventory and getting it all cleaned up, I wound up at a spiritual retreat for 3 or 4 days in Oregon and came back. And it's a couple of days later, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I don't know why God wakes me up at 2 o'clock in the morning. He seems to do that. I woke up and I said, I'm a child of a loving God, and He loves me no matter what. And I fell back asleep. Well, that was my spiritual awakening. That was my paradigm shift. Because from that moment, what I had had in my head went the long 18 inches down into my heart and stayed there. And that is what got me through 6 surgeries in a number of years with your help. Because you were always there for me. You were God in the skin to me. Well, now I'm working with people with disabilities. If somebody had told me when I got in this program 11 and a half years ago that I was going to be doing any kind of social service work, I would have said, yeah, sure. You know, I would have had my cell phone if I had one then and said, I'm on the cutting edge, man. I'm a supervisor. I got it licked. I'm high-tech heaven, making money. Well, honestly, as a result of doing these steps, my life has changed completely. What happens in the fourth step? Once we turn our wills over to God as we conceive Him, then we go through the process of seeing ourselves as we really are. And that's tough. Because we build up a lot of mechanisms in our head to justify a lot of our behavior. Because we have a lot of pain in there. And that's how we had to learn to cope with life. And what the fourth step does is it gets it all out there. And it says, you remember this instance. Well, this instance causes you to act like this. And your resentfulness at this institution has brought along this resentment and anger toward this. And it reflects itself in our behavior. I've sat on my own fourth steps with my sponsor, and I've sat on the other side with sponsorees. If you're balking on your fourth step, this I can tell you for sure. It is the most freeing thing you will ever, ever, ever experience in your life. And the only thing that's keeping you from doing it is this little voice that says, if I see myself as I really am, then what's going to replace it? Because, as we say in the book, this is an ego-deflating program. If we take in the fourth step and show you as you are, and there's no place to hide, and that means some good stuff as well as the bad stuff that we've experienced, and good qualities as well as others, then what do we replace all that with? And that's where the building process begins happening in the steps. As we get in touch with the people we've hurt and we go and make amends to them. As we take the damage and financial stuff that we build up in life and we go back and correct all of that. And if you are persistent about doing that, the promises will come true. The promises take place right around the ninth step. When you've cleaned up your house and you've gotten rid of this garbage. Because, quite unlike what people will tell you, the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is not sobriety. You can stay sober without us. There's other groups around here in which you can stay sober. You can maybe even change some of your thinking and the practice of your behavior. But this is the only program that says, when you go through these steps, that some kind of psychic change, spiritual awakening is going to happen that will dramatically change your life. Some of us have a burning bush. I've had those. Some of us have little spiritual awakenings through the day or the week or the month or the years. I've had those too. But the person that you see before you now is not the person that was when I walked in here in 1989. And this person that you see now is becoming very close to that guy I always wanted to be but never could be, because alcoholism always kept me in fear and kept me from being that person that I wanted to be. Helen Keller once said, many persons have a wrong idea of what constitutes real happiness. She's one of my heroes. It's not being obtained through self-gratification, but through fidelity to a worthy purpose. What does that mean to you? Maybe you don't know. Maybe you have no idea what a sense of a worthy purpose means. Maybe you've thought about it. Maybe you have no thought about it. But the fact of the matter is that we all have dreams. We all have aspirations. We all have things that we want to reach for. For some of us, it may be a different career. For some of us, it may be a new job. For some of us, it may be a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a husband and wife. What I want to tell you from the depths of my heart is that this program and the people in this program and the steps, if you're really honest and can do them to the best of your ability, will allow you to change your life enough that your dreams, your aspirations, your hopes will begin to come true. H.G. Wells once said, "We must not allow the clock and calendar to blind us to the fact that each moment of life is a miracle and a mystery." As alcoholics, we rarely understand that. To us, life is survival, and it goes from 1 second to the next. I remember one time I was out in the circulation ponds in Sunnyvale running, and I'm running full force. I'm stressed out. And in those percolation ponds live a whole bunch of ducks and geese. And all of a sudden I stopped dead, because here was a mama geese walking her little ducklets, or whatever they're called, across my path in front of me. And I stopped and I watched them, and watched her little tail going and all the ducks following behind her. And I sat down and bawled my eyes out, because it had been a long time since I experienced anything that simple and that beautiful. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous and God through this program can bring you. How does it start? Well, it's like this. We have a hand reached out to you. For any person in this room, the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous is here. And we're saying, yeah, you may be skeptical. Yeah, maybe there are things that you don't quite understand right now as you're sitting in the chairs, but our hand is here. Yeah, maybe there's questions about the way this change is going to happen or what it means to be sober, but our hand is here. Maybe there are things about relationships you don't quite understand on yourself, and you don't know what's going to happen in the future. Our hand is here. And the first step to getting these dreams and these aspirations and these hopes to come alive in your life is when you reach out your hand, the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous, will reach out and touch yours and pull you up. It really is that simple. Thanks.
I'd like to thank our speaker, Gary, for a wonderful meeting. Our readers, Jim and CM, and to remind you that there will be tapes available after the meeting, and we also have a raffle. And we're now closing the meeting with the Lord's Prayer.